Welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
Amazing Grace.
Today we move out of John chapter 4 and into chapter 5. And chapter 5 gives the extended account of Christ healing the lame man at the pool of Bethesda on the Sabbath day. And it is a very instructive account, and it is a very pivotal point in the ministry of Christ. It is the third miracle selected by John. I'm not saying it's a third miracle performed by Christ, but the third miracle carefully selected by John out of many other miracles that he could have recorded, but selected to convince his readers that Jesus is the Christ. The first one, the water turned to wine at Cana of Galilee. The second one, the healing of the nobleman's son, also in Cana. And by the way, the first one's recorded in John chapter 2, and the second one in John chapter 4. But here's a third one, the healing of the lame man on the Sabbath day, and this one takes place in Jerusalem rather than in Galilee. Jerusalem, the center of Jewish influence and authority, and this one is clearly designed by Christ deliberately to challenge that Jewish authority. It also introduces the longest discourse thus far by John, that is, the longest sermon, the longest section of a message spoken by Christ. And in this message, Christ proclaims, explains, and defends his claim to deity and his unity with the Father. This is also probably the first of several confrontations with the Jews over the question of Sabbath day observances. That Christ is the Lord of the Sabbath as well as the Lord of everything else. And so it's a very important chapter. We'll have to break it down into small pieces as we work our way through it, but there's a lot to learn. I'm glad you're with us on this Sunday, July 28. I'm grateful for those radio listeners whose financial gifts enable us to keep teaching God's Word on this station as we pay the bills for the airtime. And I pray that the Lord will bless our study in John chapter 5. Now, before the events in John chapter 5, the Jewish religious leaders were watching Jesus very closely, and it seems primarily were watching him with curiosity. They were viewing him with concern. They were concerned about his rising popularity and what appeared to be his succession to the popular ministry of John the Baptist. But it is after this incident in John chapter 5 that they expressed their determination to kill him. This is, therefore, a significant milestone in Christ's earthly ministry. The Jews go from curiosity to extreme animosity. I couldn't say that they had friendly attitudes toward him before, in other words, that there was no animosity, but it's at this point that the animosity rises to such a high pitch that they are ready to put him to death and are just looking for how they can do so. Christ claims to authority, his authority. He is Lord of the Sabbath, as well as other things, and his claims to authority threaten the established religious authority of first century Judaism, and claims like his must be suppressed by these leaders if they're going to maintain their position of authority. That seems to be the main issue here. They're butting heads over who's in charge of the Jewish religion. The Jewish religious leaders, who considered themselves to be in charge, insisted that they were in charge, installed themselves in positions of authority and defended that authority, and most people had been willing to bow to that. But Jesus now, claiming authority over the Jewish religion, that it is his religion, not theirs. It is his word that counts, not theirs. It is his Father that must be worshipped, not theirs. They do not have a relationship with God the Father that they should. He is the proper successor of the religion that was first established with Abraham, though they considered themselves to be the successor to that. So there's a real confrontation that is set up here. And we can see why this conflict begins. And so let's begin with the background in chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. That's the background. And it begins with Christ's dutiful attendance at a Jewish feast. A minor interruption in his Galilean ministry, because you recall in chapter 4, we read how he traveled from Judea to Galilee, but deliberately through Samaria, and his wonderful ministry there with the woman at the well, and then beyond that to a great multitude of people in Samaria, but from Samaria on to Galilee, which was his intended destination for a while. But now he goes back to Judea, no doubt as an obedient and exemplary attendant at one of the Jewish pilgrim feasts, and we're not told which one. Was it Passover? Was it Pentecost? Was it Tabernacles? Those were the three that the Jewish males were commanded to attend in Jerusalem, and if they were observant Jews, they did. Passover, of course, we're familiar with that, established back in the days of Egypt when they were released from Egyptian bondage with the Passover meal that was inaugurated at that time to demonstrate the necessity of the shedding of a lamb as a sacrifice, as a propitiation, as a substitute, and that the blood of the lamb put upon the door lintels was the reminder that without the shedding of blood, there's no remission of sin, and so forth. Pentecost, as it's called in these days, was in the Old Testament called the Feast of Weeks, or First Fruits. It took place 7 weeks after Passover, so almost 2 months, 50 days. That's why it's called Pentecost. 50 is five. Pentecost is 50, 50 days, 7 weeks plus 1 day. And so in the Old Testament, called the Feast of Weeks or of First Fruits, this was a celebration when the first fruit offerings were given to the Lord in acknowledgement that all of the harvest came only by his blessing and that all of it was his, but he, of course, had given it to them for their own physical needs, but he should be acknowledged and honored in an offering out of the first fruits, and that was done during the Feast of Pentecost, as it came to be known in New Testament days. And then finally, the Feast of Tabernacles, or Booths. Now, we don't know which of these three, but Jesus like an obedient Jew, obeying the law of Moses and the command to attend these feast days at the temple, did so obediently, and that brought him to Jerusalem and into contact with this lame man at the Pool of Bethesda. And we're given some background here about the healing, and I'm not quite sure what to call them. I'm tempted to call them healing legends connected with the Pool of Bethesda. There were reports and hopes regarding healing at this pool, which was by the Sheep Gate. You can read about that in Nehemiah chapter 3 and Nehemiah chapter 12. The Sheep Gate, north of the temple area, where the sheep were brought in for sacrifice, brought in from the places where they were pastured and intended and made ready to bring in, because the Jewish temple required an enormous number of animal sacrifices daily, multiple animals every day, and then additional ones for special feast days like Passover. And so there was a special gate where these were brought in to the temple, the Sheep Gate it was called, because that's the primary purpose for it, was to bring sheep through that gate. Not that others were prohibited from using it, but that was its primary purpose. And there, in that general vicinity of the Sheep Gate, north of the temple area, there was a pool, a large open reservoir, a double pool, we are told, that had five porches, we would probably call them porticos, five covered colonnades. You know what that would be? The sides are large columns that support the roof. It's an open air porch. That's why it's called a porch. We all have porches. We're all familiar with porches. And generally, a porch is an open air addition to a house, usually at the front of the back, the front porch or the back porch, that it has a roof overhead and in some cases some pretty substantial columns that are holding up the roof, but generally is open to the outside. It's not walled in like the house itself. It's a porch, not a room. It may be a screened-in porch, as we have at our house, and therefore it's open to the outside, but it filters out the pollen and the leaves and the debris and so forth, but still allows the air to pass it through. And then some people will have a porch that is closed in. In fact, some people even take a porch that was built originally as an open porch and close it in. And as soon as they do that, it isn't usually called a porch anymore. It's called what? Maybe a sunroom, or something like that. A porch is an open area, and this pool, which was large, had five covered colonnades, and around that pool, a sizable collection of handicapped people who were weak and powerless, without strength. They were crippled. They were disfigured in various ways. They were people who were handicapped, as we would call them today, and they were hoping for a miraculous cure. Forward, we read in verse, I'll go back and read all of this in a moment, but we read in verse 4 that there was an angel who came down at certain times and stirred the water, and whoever got into the water first after the stirring by the angel was made whole. And of course, as this story goes on, we find that this man who Jesus healed was at that spot, at that location, obviously hoping for a healing miracle, but because of his condition, he didn't seem to be able to get in soon enough. Others always got in before him. It was only the first one who was able to be healed by this miraculous means. And so here were these people hoping for a miraculous cure. Now the question is, was real healing going on here? When it says an angel came down, is it saying that this is actually what happened, that God sent an angel down and that whoever got into the pool whenever the angel stirred the waters was actually healed, or is this the description of a legend, that this is what people thought, this is what people said, this is what people hoped? They were hoping against hope, 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 that if they could get into the pool when the water was stirred, presumably by a breeze. I mean, if you're at a pool and a breeze comes along, the water is stirred, and this would probably happen several times a day. And if, in fact, people were getting healed there every time the water was stirred, whoever was the first one in was getting healed, there must have been, over the course of a year, hundreds and thousands of people being healed in this way, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. The miraculous healing by Jesus was the only real healing that seemed to be going on in that day. There's no evidence that there was any other going on. So I take this to be a legend. John is saying this is what people thought. This is why they hung around the pool. This was the report. This was the legend that many people believed. That's what I take it to mean. And that gives us a background, and I want to read the verses again, because now that I've explained it, I think reading them again, they'll fall into focus a little better. After this, that is after Christ's ministry in Galilee that was reported in chapter 4, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. That sets the background for what comes next with the healing of Christ and the recipient of this healing that is recorded in this chapter. And for that, I read the next several verses. Now, verse 5, a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. Dun, 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 dun. We're going to read that a lot throughout the Gospels. Healings that take place on the Sabbath. It's clear to me that Christ deliberately healed on the Sabbath more frequently than any other day. He frequently challenged the authority of the religious leaders by his healing on the Sabbath, because that forced this issue as to who's Lord of the Sabbath. Did they have the right to command that healings not be done on the Sabbath, which is what they were saying, because they said, well, that falls into the category of work, and you can't do work on the Sabbath. And the Old Testament makes it clear that you can do acts of mercy on the Sabbath. On one occasion, Jesus said, "Why, you hypocrites, if your ox or your donkey falls into a ditch on the Sabbath day, you don't wait until the next day to pull him out. You take pity upon your animal, you recognize the need to get him out," and of course, not only your compassion for the animal, which is the ostensible reason, but there's also another reason, and that is so you don't suffer financial loss by the lingering of your animal in that condition too long, so that it's going to take him a few days to recover. You get him out as quickly as possible on the Sabbath day. You don't mind bending your own rules on the Sabbath day in order to minister to an animal and to protect your own financial interest, but you object to my healing human beings who are of much more value than animals, for no financial profit, no financial advantage. You object to my doing that on the Sabbath day? You're being hypocritical. And your insistence that you set the rules for the Sabbath day is contested by Christ again and again and again and again. He heals on the Sabbath day. And so here it's a Sabbath day. He went to the pool. It's pretty obvious. He knew who was there. Of course, he knew this particular man was there, but he knew exactly what he was going to find there. A whole collection of people that are described in verse 3. Sick people, blind people, lame people, paralyzed people, all kinds of people. He knew that's who would be there. And he went there with the intention of healing one of them on the Sabbath day. Of course he did. And there is one particularly pitiful case that Christ singles out in this collection of needy people. Verse 5, now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. One from among many, a certain man who'd had an infirmity for 38 years. Apparently some kind of lameness. We don't know exactly what it was, but his problem was, as he later explains, that whenever the water was stirred, other people were successful in getting it into the pool before him. While he was trying to come down into the pool, he obviously wasn't confined to a bed. He was able to get up and move, but slowly, slowly, you can almost picture this man, perhaps with his walking stick, walking awkwardly, slowly, with great difficulty, time and time and time and time again. He gets up when the water's stirred, and he slowly and awkwardly moves to the pool and tries to get in. Apparently, there were steps down into the pool, and he couldn't get there first. A particularly pitiful case. And to this man, Christ directs an arresting question. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made whole?" Christ saw him. Christ knew about his condition. How did he know that? How did he know that he'd been in that condition a long time? Well, there may have been something about the situation that communicated that to him, but it seems much more likely that this is an exercise of his omniscience. He knows all things. And there is an interesting and mysterious interplay between Christ, the eternal Son of God, and Christ, the incarnate Son of Man. And we see this interplay from time to time in Christ's life. There are times when he doesn't seem to know things. Obviously, his deity is not being exercised at that time, because as God, he cannot help but know everything. And there are times when he does not engage his deity. And what is known to him in his humanity is only what any ordinary human man can know by the use of sight and what he hears, what he's told. But on this occasion, he seems to know more. He seems to know that this man has been here for a long time. Maybe he knows exactly how long he's been there, 38 years. And so he must have been exercising his deity on this occasion. And so he saw him and he knew him and he engaged him. "Do you want to be made whole?" Interesting question. Someone would say, "Well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?" But Christ doesn't do anything without a purpose, a good purpose. "Do you want to be made whole?" Jesus says to him, which, number one, focuses attention of this man on the one who's able to heal, rather than just going and assuming that, of course, he wants to be made whole. Everybody there wants to be made whole. And just going there and saying, "I heal you, I heal you, I heal you, I heal you. Bam, 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 bam. I go around the pool and heal everybody here," which he could have done. He asks this man a question which causes that man to focus upon the one who's speaking to him, the one who's asking the question. He needs to focus upon Christ. And so it focuses attention upon the one, the only one, who's able to heal. I don't really think there was, as I've already explained, there was any healing in the pool. but there is healing in the Son of God. And so his attention is focused upon the one who is truly able to heal him, and it arouses in his hope encouragement. He's been lying there a long time trying to get healed. He must have been at the least in his 50s, maybe 60s of age at this time. He'd been infirm for 38 years, must have had an accident many years ago. Wasn't born this way, but he'd been this way a long, long time, 38 years that he's been crippled, has been disabled, and has longed to be made well, and has been trying to get healed by this pool and the legend that is attached to it, but he's not able to accomplish it. And this question by Christ causes him to acknowledge his powerlessness to save himself. Do you want to be made well? Instead of saying, well, of course I want to be made well. The sick man answered him, sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me. He does acknowledge his powerlessness to help himself, but he's, of course, focusing upon the pool, upon the legend of the angel, upon self-effort. He just doesn't have enough within himself to do what could be done to accomplish healing by himself, is what he seems to be saying. Of course, obviously, it takes the angel to do it, but if he could just get there a little bit more quickly, then he wouldn't need Jesus to heal him. It could be done another way. It could be done in a more human way, but he needs a little help. He lacks a human helper. He lacks somebody who can assist him so he can get down more quickly. I have no man to put me into the pool when the water stirred up. But while I am coming, painfully, slowly, another steps down before me. And so he seems to think if he could just get a little bit of help, then his need could be met, which of course is evidence of the delusion that most people have in regard to salvation. And all of this is an illustration of salvation. Here's a man who is helpless in himself, but he's reluctant to admit. He doesn't say, yes, I long to be healed, and there's nothing that I can do for myself. I am helpless. I am weak. I am powerless. I can't do anything toward my own healing. But he is holding on to the delusion that if he could get a little bit of help, then he could make it happen. That's the way a lot of people are with salvation. They may realize that being good enough to be saved, as most people think that that's the way to be saved, is through self-righteousness. To be good enough to be saved is a little beyond their ability. They realize they fall short. But if they could just get a little help to lift them above their circumstances and their habits and so forth, then they could get it done. Well, we'll have to take it up again next week. Until then, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.